Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
Live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue on heritageradionetwork.org. You can also download and listen to the show through iTunes or Stitcher. I'm your host, Lady Sue. What do I do when I'm not hosting this show? I'm out and abouting, having the very conversations that you hear on my show, and working with my clients, which include chefs, sommeliers, big brands, startups, all those doing what's most innovative and delicious. Today, we'll jump straight into our super special in-studio guest on hashtag people we like. We have in the studio here with me Chef David Burke, who at 26 years old helmed the kitchen at the famed River Cafe in Brooklyn. Now he's got an empire of restaurants around the country. Here in New York City, there's DB Kitchen, DB Townhouse, Fishtail, and you see his name in Bloomingdale's as well. We'll talk how his dad tried to dissuade him from cooking, how he once got worst dish of the year and how he coped, and how he learned how to open a clam the fastest. So stay till the end, because to wind it down, we'll head down to Atrium Dumbo to talk to partner sommelier Alex LaPratt, who was named Best Sommelier by the American Sommelier Association. He's worked at many, many, many Michelin 2- and 3-star spots, including Atera, Jean Georges, and La Renaudin. I'm your host, Leyte Sue. You're listening to Word of Mouth with Leyte Sue on heritageradionetwork.org. You can tweet at us, hashtag WOMSHOW. Our in-studio guest is at Chef David Burke. I'm at Leyte Sue, L-E-I-T-I-H-S-U, at Heritage underscore radio, as always. And now for people we like. Welcome, David.
Nice to be here.
So,
how you doing?
Good. So, you may not have realized, but the intro to my show is actually our mutual friend, Jackie Gordon.
Oh, that, I did recognize that now that you say it.
Is it?
Yes.
Is it? She's Jackie so Gordon. Wonderful.
She's great. She's
you guys
great.
She used to work
and
together.
She cooks well.
River Cafe, right?
We worked at the River Cafe together, and we one time we're trying to put together a singing cooking show. She sings wonderfully, and she cooks pretty well, too.
So I think you guys need to get back in touch, because she recently just did a Choc Cabaret.
That's correct.
Chocolate. She sings you through a chocolate tasting, and it's fabulous.
Yeah.
She even wears a necklace made out of fake chocolates.
Nice.
Yeah, stylish lady.
She should get real chocolates for that.
I think you could collaborate on that. Do something molecular to prevent
so
it from melting.
Melt, yeah.
Or maybe it melts and it's sort of an art piece.
Yeah.
Was she working front of house or back of house?
Jackie worked front of the house at the River Cafe. This is back, I guess, early 90s, late 80s when she worked there. I was there from 85 to 92.
And but this is your first time on Heritage Radio.
Yes, it is.
Welcome.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
And we have another person who worked for you, Ken Oranger. He came on as the first guest on my show in 2014.
Wow! Okay, yeah. Kenny, he's doing good in New York.
Yeah.
Kenny worked for me at the River Cafe also.
Yeah, as a cook, right?
He was a pastry assistant.
Pastry assistant.
He was a cook. He did his internship or externship, they call it, from the Culinary Institute of America, and he was a good kid, Jersey boy. Very inquisitive. And we worked him hard. Yeah. He may have worked there a little longer than the internship, though. I think he did.
Really?
Yeah.
I was just at his restaurant yesterday.
Yeah, Toro.
Yep. Yeah. Wonderful.
Doing well, yeah.
I should have asked him what to ask you.
Okay. Yeah,
you So how many restaurants, I can't keep track, how many restaurants do you have in total now?
We have 9 restaurants that are open currently.
Mm-hmm.
We're opening David Burke Townhouse, which was my first one, which was opened as David Burke and Donatello, is under renovation. So that one will reopen mid-March. We are opening in Manhattan another one in mid to the third week of April. It's in the Archer Hotel. It's on 38th Street between 5th and 6th with a rooftop bar, and we're excited about that. We're also opening in Aspen, Colorado, in, let's say, early May, mid-May. At this point, we're pretty much delayed out there, which is, you know, so we've missed the winter season, and we'll probably open for Food and Wine Classic
nice.
In Aspen, so we should open that one in May, and we're scheduled to open two in Chicago. We currently have one in Chicago called David Burke Prime House, which is a highly regarded steakhouse, if not the best steakhouse in town. At least that's what Chicago Magazine and many others say. I don't like to say that because I think it becomes a matter of opinion.
Of course.
When you get into that, the best of the best.
Of course.
And we're going to open a Burke in a Box in Chicago this summer, sometimes later in the summer. And about this time next year, we're going to open a David Burke Kitchen on Michigan Avenue. So we're pretty busy over the next 18 months or so.
Four new restaurants.
Yeah.
One reopening, three new brand new restaurants.
Four new ones. One reopening, four new ones, yeah.
So I think out of all of my guests I've ever had, you have the most restaurants. Like what's your week like?
My week?
Yeah, I want to know.
Well, this week, I'll tell you what my weekend was like.
Okay, cool, let's start there.
And then I can kind of gauge you through my week. I went, what'd I do? I looked at another location in Boca. So I flew to Boca on Saturday night. I looked at a property down there and had a nice dinner. Walked through parts of Boca, stayed at the Boca Resort, which I basically just slept there. Flew home in the a.m., and I went out to look at something in the Hamptons.
Oh, my God.
And I had a lunch there and spent time with a friend. And then I visited another friend. Then I had a nice kind of leisurely day and came back home. I live in Fort Lee, New Jersey,
mm-hmm.
over near the Bridge Gate. Right near the Bridge Gate. And and I'm here today to start my week off. I have 4 or 5 meetings after this today.
Mm-hmm.
Menu changes. I have a new chef that started today. Actually, started yesterday. We're going to get together with him and fine-tune some menus. And then I got a couple interviews. And it is restaurant week in New York City. So two of our restaurants are participating. So it's quite busy.
Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow I am spending an afternoon with a potential new hire chef also that will travel. I think this weekend I'm going to either fly to Aspen to check in on things, or I'll do that the following weekend. So I have, because the restaurants are kind of delayed and we don't really have set dates, it's hard to commit to anything. Like, I would have been to Miami this weekend for Food and Wine Festival if I didn't realize, you know, you never know when you're going to open because, you know, building takes time. And Charlie Palmer, who I worked for at the mm-hmm. River Cafe, is having a festival out in Sonoma, which I couldn't sign up for because I thought I'd be opening this weekend in Aspen. So Aspen is delayed, so that kind of delayed some. So I kind of have to keep my schedule open
mm-hmm.
because I have to be ready to, you know, over the next 6 months, I can't really commit to going on a cruise or flying somewhere, you know, spending any amounts of time anywhere because I have to be loose on my schedule.
Right. Yeah. Well, this year is unusual in the history of the company, right? There seemed to be it's a big year for growth.
Yes. You know, we try to space things out, but it didn't, you know, opportunities come and, you know, we really should have had one of these open in December, one of them in March, and the next one in July. And, you know, it doesn't work that way sometimes. So we do have the infrastructure of being able to do this correctly. Fortunately, we have that, and unfortunately, because it costs a lot of money while you're not opening to have these have employees and managers on board. But the training just gets extended, and the silver lining should be the smooth openings all around. So.
Mm-hmm. And when you are the boss and you're opening a bunch of places, you know, what do you try to be there for? I mean, you have people who can train then more people. You know, what are the key key moments that you as David have to be there for?
Well, a lot of the work, believe it or not, is the planning stages. You know, the style of the restaurant. We have a kitchen in Soho, David Burke Kitchen. We're opening that in Aspen. We're opening that in Chicago. Mm-hmm. The new one in New York is a small plate restaurant, which we don't have the concept. We don't have a small plate restaurant. We certainly can know how to make a plate of food. So we needed to just get that small plate concept down pat and make sure we have the right amount of dishes, the right kind of dishes, the right variety of dishes, enough wow factor, enough simple, et cetera, you know, the right amount of vegetarian. We're going to put some vegetarian emphasis on this menu. So the designing of it and planning the food, the look, the feel, the sound of all that. And then when we do get and training, pre-training, and then we get to the point of opening. Openings are always difficult. They're just hard. There's so many moving parts. Even if you do a lot of them, it's still something. There's a lot of things that could go wrong, and usually something does. You know, that causes delay, or something didn't get shipped, or, you know, so you just deal with it and you get through it. And, you know, training, systems, all that stuff has to come into play when you open it. Then it's quality control. Quality control is really something that I need to focus on when we open.
You swoop in and taste stuff?
Oh, absolutely. I'm usually in the kitchens for a good month if I can, full-time, if not more, depending on other openings. You know, like if I go to Aspen, I'll spend a month out there when we open. A good month of every day, you know, working and fine-tuning and changing and editing. Editing's a good word. We edit what we started with and, you know, and then line them all up together and feel it. You know, and then we also listen to feedback from guests. Is this the right thing, the right feel, the right taste, the right, you know. Yeah. It's hard, but it's fun.
38th Street. I'm super excited about this one. It sounds what I, you know, as somebody, I wasn't eating in New York during the days of when you were at the River Cafe, but you did so much that was so, like, no one had heard of Lotus Root, and sweetbreads and offal weren't, like, as trendy as they, trendy, I used the word trendy, I never used that word, as, you know, on the forefront of people's minds as they are now. You know, you did stuff like you put stuff on top of bone marrow that's never been on top of bone marrow before. I mean, you know, reading Flo Fab's, you know, piece on your food at the River Cafe, it was just so darn creative. And I'm wondering if we're going to see more of that in the small plates at this new spot.
Yeah, you know what? The small plates concept, you can do a little bit more of that, I think, because it's a small plate. It's not your whole meal. People are more adventurous with small plates, you know, especially, you know, they don't want to take an experiment with a $45 main course, you know, experiment with a $12 small plate, or they'll try something and know it's not their whole meal. So back at the River in the 80s, late 80s, you know, we had a great clientele, of an international clientele, and we could sell it. We could sell lots of stuff, and Buzzy O'Keefe, the owner, was like, run with it, you know. So we were smoking kidneys and making bacon out of kidneys, and we built a smokehouse.
Wow.
So we were doing a lot of craftsmanship type of work, but also at the finest level, because it was a 3-star restaurant. But we were renegades in the back of the house. And, I mean, you know, there was no, forget labor laws. We were just, you know, you showed up, you know, there was a line to come in and work. It was really a special time in American cooking as far as being creative. We kind of were spearheading some of the, as well as other chefs in New York and around the country, spearheading some of the creative freedoms of, you know, why does it have to be Dover sole? You know, kind of breaking away from tradition, but still putting a fabulous collection of ingredients on a plate.
What was the landscape like back then? What other restaurants were just opening?
You know, you had, I worked for Charlie Palmer at the River for a couple of years, Charlie. So you had, you know, Charlie, and I worked for Wally Maloof, who was chef at Beacon and Rainbow. But I worked for him at a French restaurant in Westchester called La Cremaire. And they also owned La Caravelle at the time. So there's a lot of great French restaurants back then. Le Cirque and La Grenouille are still around. But not many other. La Bernardin just opened. I think they opened in 84, 85. Mm-hmm. Gotham Bar and Grill was fairly new.
Union Square.
Union Square was, I think, 85, 86. Mm-hmm. You know, River Cafe was opened in the 77. Larry Ford Joan had started the drum beating at the River Cafe and this American food revolution, so to say. La Côte Basque was a big restaurant. Where Park Avenue Cafe was called Perigo Park, was very well known. You know, you had Messine. You had a lot of French restaurants. I worked for Danielle at the Plaza Athenae Hotel that just brand newly opened in 84. Sign of the Dove was a restaurant that was around. American restaurants, there wasn't a lot. You know, you had Keene Steakhouse, you had Smith & Wesson. Yeah, you didn't have a lot of. Arizona 206 was a southwestern style restaurant that had opened, and I'm trying to think. Le Cirque was very hot back then, and mm-hmm. you know, so you had a lot. There was a lot of your French restaurants. Mm-hmm. Four Seasons was American. 21 Club was booming, but you didn't have a lot of. There was very few well-known American chefs, you know. Back, you know, it was mostly the. If you wanted to come out of the CIA back then and get your bones, you worked in a French restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for the most part back then, you went. You looked in the. I don't know if the Zagat guy just started, but wow. You looked at some of the other guidebooks and knocked on doors and sent resumes.
So, speaking of the CIA, you attended there, but you got your chops even before then, your cooking chops. Your dad didn't want you to go into cooking, though. What does he do, by the way? What did he do?
My dad drove a subway.
All right.
In New York City.
And, oh, wow.
I probably worked out here somewhere in Bushwick. I was born in Bed-Stuy, and we moved to the Jersey Shore when I was one. So it's interesting for me to come back in 85 to live in Brooklyn Heights. My uncle lived in Brooklyn Heights, and I actually stayed with my other uncle for a couple months till I got some cash together to get an apartment in Brooklyn Heights, and he lived in Queens. But, yeah, my dad drove a train, and he became a train instructor. So he was he worked for the train system for his whole career. And
your mom?
My mom had odd jobs here and there, worked as a nurse here and there, and then with four kids, stop and go work again and, you know, stuff like that. So my parents, we didn't eat out a lot. We were simple, simple food. My dad, though, was a health guy. He ran marathons back then, which is so strange because no one didn't have any friends that ran either. He just, like, put shorts on, started running around. And people were like, what's he doing? He's like, jogging. What's that? So he stayed in shape. And so in our household, we didn't have any soda, no sugar, no sweets, no processed foods. And we were eating wheat germ and skim milk and brown bread.
Ahead of his time.
In the 70s, yeah. And he wasn't like a hippie guy either. It was just, still can't figure out what. I must have read a magazine on a train or something where Boston said, oh, this sounds like a good idea. But it really, I mean, I don't eat that way now. I don't drink soda. And so his idea was a belief anyway. It was that it just drained you of your energy for school and such. So anyway, so he had ideas of me. I was a good student. I was a pretty good athlete, and I was very creative back then, and I was the oldest son. My sister's a little older than me, and, you know, he had the dream of, you know, like, oh, you know, be a lawyer or, you know, go to
all those things that parents want you to go do.
Yes, and I told him I wanted to be a chef, and I wish I had a camera to take a picture of his face. He's like, you're shitting me. Like, he didn't believe me. He was just like, and back then, you got to realize it wasn't a great career choice. You know, it was not like it is now. There was really no nothing to compare it to. You know what I mean? And it's funny because...
He's like, you want to go be a laborer.
Right, you want to work in a kitchen. And for him, you know, you think about like Mel's Diner, the TV shows. And he was in the Army, so he's like thinking Army cooks. You know, we didn't belong to a country club. You know, it wasn't like... Even a country club back then, the chef was really... Probably a European guy or someone that was trained in the Army that became a country club chef. There was really not... The CIA was in its infancy still. Right, I mean, it started in 47, but it went to Hyde Park in 74. So people didn't really, it wasn't a college thing. Be a chef was not, you know, so I had to convince him, and I did. He actually signed me up for a cooking school in a mall down in Eatontown. And I had to hitchhike there. I was like 16. And
kind of like a William Sonoma kind of like
It was like a
William
Sonoma, way ahead of its time. It's called Contemporary Cooking Center.
Whoa.
And it had a basement with all these high-end kitchens. And they had Julia Child, Marcella Hazan, all the cookbook authors. I had no idea who they were back then. Would come and
How old were you?
Teach. 16.
Okay.
So I went there. I had a broken arm. I remember this. I have a couple of photos laying around somewhere. Long hair. And I'm like, he signs me up for two classes, I guess. One was basic cooking or Mediterranean or something. And I'm sitting there, and it's, you know, he figured I'd be discouraged. All housewives. They drink wine. You know, it was like get out of the house, learn how to make, you know, pot of foo or something like that. And sit around, and you eat the meal, and you drink wine, and, you know, whatever it is. I have no idea what the price is. And I'm sitting there, and I'm fascinated by the ingredients. Just the, you know, just seeing raw ingredients that are not from a modern household. You know, like a rack of veal. Or, you know, making a bouquet, or making real soup from scratch. You know, my mom made decent food, but she didn't cook. You know what I mean? She didn't, like, whip out a cutting board and a French knife and start whacking things up. You know, she was like, simpler the better. You know, like the salt, you know, you seasoned your own food. applesauce is a mainstay, man. It's like,
here, so, ketchup, mustard, salt, pepper.
So I sat there and I was like, wow. So at the end of the night of the class, a woman who ran it, she's a friend of mine named Miriam Brickman in New York City. She ran the new school and taught for many years. She asked me if I wanted a job. They said they needed someone to set up all the recipes for the cookbook authors.
So you showed enough talent with one broken arm to...
She hired me that day. I said, what do you mean? She goes, well, we'll pay you, I don't know, $3 an hour, $3.25, whatever minimum wage was back then. And she says, you get all the classes, you come in, we'll pay you, and you can, you know, you do the setups. And you can help us break down and wash the wine glasses. And I'm like, I'm in. So I went home and told my dad, you know, he's like, yeah, he thought I'd be like, this sucks. I'm not doing that. Yeah. And I came back and said, yeah, I signed up for all the other classes. And like, he thought, you know, I like swiped his credit card or something. I don't know. And so that I did that for 6 months. Unfortunately, the school closed. And I learned a lot about, like I just touched a lot about, I was exposed to Moroccan cooking, Chinese cooking, Japanese cooking, because I had all these different classes. So I kind of got exposed, as silly as it sounds, couscous and miso, and I got exposed to these things that you wouldn't even see at the CIA when I went to the CIA. So I kind of, it really opened my mind a lot to what was out there. So then I just got supercharged and excited about what I could learn.
Mm. And did you stand out because you were like the one teenage boy among like a whole sea of housewives in this class?
Different generation back then. I wish it was not. No, yeah, I was the only guy. Yeah, I was obviously. I sat in the back and I was people. You know, I was personable, but I don't. You know, I was determined to learn about food, and you know, I didn't feel awkward being there. I was the only teenager there by far.
I just wonder why they noticed you. You asked a lot of questions?
No, it was obvious to notice me. I was like a kid curious. They asked me what I was doing there. Like, thought I was lost or something. Like, you know, it's like, what? I said, I want to be a chef and I want to learn. And that's why I signed up. And she was probably like, well, good, because I'm tired of setting all this stuff up and doing all these dishes. So this is a match. We need you. You want to learn? We'll teach you for free, and you can work. So that's often how jobs work in the restaurant industry too. You start out as one position, all of a sudden somebody quits, you're like, okay, you're moving over here. You're going to move here now. Whether you like it or not, you're doing pastry. Whether you like it or not, you're working the grill, you know. And you just adapt and you get into it. And it was just a good learning experience. And they did close and it was bad, you know. Then I had to go get another job. I got a job at a country. I got very lucky to get a job at a country club in Navasink, and not far from a restaurant I own in Rumson now called Dave Burke Fromagerie. And then I really learned how to be a cook. A line cook and a butcher and all that good stuff that comes with working your butt off for, you know, 80 hours a week and trying to do everything. And I was the youngest by far in the country club kitchen. And the more I did, the less the chefs and sous chefs had to do. And so I was just like, yeah, I'll do it. Okay, I can do that. Yeah, I can, you know. And then came the day when I asked the guy to help me open a clam.
But what were your exact words?
I said, show me how to open a clam real fast. The fastest way to open a clam.
Got it.
Because this guy was so fast. I couldn't do it. I just didn't know how to do it. And I knew how to cut meat by then. I was a broiler guy, so I did all the meats and all that. And
so you were an acquisitive pain in the ass.
Yes, I was. I took notes, kept a notebook. And they would write funny stuff in my notes because I left it like above my station, you know. And then I'd come in like, you know, after my day off and I'd be like... really screwy, like shitty recipes in there, like, like obscenities. And I'm like, I don't remember writing that. So, you know, and that's just common kitchen
camaraderie.
You know, camaraderie and messing around. And these were a bunch of, you know, I was young, so these guys were older. And I liked it, though. It's a lot, a good sense of teamwork. And it very much reminded me of a sport, actually, where, you know, you got 9 or 10 guys in a kitchen. Crunch time comes, and you got to be ready. And it's kind of like, you know, it was like, and you get through that 3 or 4 or 5 hour service, like, you know, just if somebody goes down, it's not good. You know, it's like dropping a pass. So it felt like that. It was part of something pretty good. Not knowing what would happen over the next 20, 30 years in food in America.
Huh.
You know, this was just the beginning. And there's many guys in that generation that went to the CIA at that time or didn't that are now my age that are, you know what, that would really, I think we really had a true passion for food. It had nothing to do with where we would end up or what the opportunities were. It was just pioneering, wanting to be a great chef.
Not so, mm-hmm. And so this guy came over and showed you how to open a clam.
His name was John Dombrowski. And he was a few years older. We were pals. And we got in some trouble together. He was like, you know, he's like an older brother I never had. And so we were kind of, you know, and he was a very good cook, fast, you know, and like knew all the tricks and all the shortcuts and all that, you know, when he wouldn't get flustered, you know. So I'm like, Johnny, you know, can you, if I come in early, like Saturday, will you show me how to open a clam real fast, like the fastest way?
How early did you come in?
I was like 8 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday. I mean, normally I probably went in at 11 or 12. And he said, yeah, no problem. And he goes, so I went in and he's like, okay, get a bunch of clay. I put them on the butcher block. And I had my notebook. I was standing there with my chef coat on, my chef T-shirt, whatever the hell we wore back then. And he goes, here's how you open a clam. Fast. He took a meat hammer from behind his back and started smashing it. And all the, you know, the meat and pulp and the shells went all over my shirt. And I was like, okay, got dumb question, I guess. So then he showed me how to do it the correct way about a week later. But that's...
he just left you with all the clam guts?
Clean it up, get to work, et cetera, et cetera. Stop asking so many questions. I was like, okay, got it. I guess that is the fastest way to open a clam. I got my answer.
Well, I think some young fellows, those 15-year-old type of guys out there can learn from us, because back then there may have been housewives in that cooking class, but I think these days there are a lot of young ladies. That's where to meet the young ladies. That's my piece of advice to my audience in case there are any teenage boys who want to be just like Chef
David. Or girls,
David.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But if you can't go to a cooking class and meet any boys, because there's just, I don't know, girls like food more still.
Yeah. I think you're right.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
That's my piece of advice. And we are going to take a really quick commercial break. But after we come back, we're going to talk about the one time that Chef David Burke got the worst dish of the year and how he dealt with that. Or didn't.
You are listening to Presidential Pardon by TaxStar on the heritageradionetwork.org. Stay tuned for more from Word of Mouth with A.T. Sue.
Wednesday at noon, Dorothy Cann Hamilton, founder and CEO of the International Culinary Center, interviews the top chefs in the world on Chef Story. Hear from chefs like Christina Tosi.
I'm going to be the best pastry cook this restaurant's ever seen.
Francis Malman.
Cooking with fire, it's very feminine, it's very fragile.
And Jacques Pepin.
I was invited to work at the White House for John Kennedy.
Learn how the greats become great every Wednesday at 12 p.m. on Chef Story. HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth with Leyte Sue on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm in the studio with Chef David Burke. So, tell me about the one time you got the worst dish of the year.
Like, this is a great story.
How'd you?
I was at the River Cafe. We're flying to Toronto. Drew Nierpont has asked me to, and we're friendly, and he's asked me to go to Toronto to check out a chef with him who Robert De Niro really likes to open Tribeca Grill. This is before Tribeca Grill opened. And he wants my opinion. I'm like, okay, I'll go with you. You know, why not? Well, you know, I've never been to Toronto. So it's, by the way, it's the coldest day ever. Still in my life, it was the coldest day ever. So, one, it was next to Quebec. Canada's so cold. Anyway, so we go up there. I get up there, and I didn't bring a passport. So they won't let me on the plane. At the beginning, they're like... Drew checks in first. I guess it was LaGuardia, and he goes to David Burke check, and I'm running late. And the guy says, David Burke will not be on this plane because I didn't have my passport. Drew, this is the same day that Florence Fabricant article came out from the River Cafe. So my picture's on the cover of the dining section. So we use that. The guy lets us use that as our passport. He goes, I don't know if you're going to get back with that, but I'm going to let you go.
Thank you for
that. And he lets me go with that. That's like, you know.
That's so amazing. So
that's the New York Times. We get on the plane, and we're reading USA Today. And on USA Today, USA Today lists, I don't know, top 10 or top 5 best issues of the year, top 10, worst issue of the year, whatever. Maybe it's top 5. Anyway, worst issue of the year, number 1. I think it was number 1. Maybe it was number 3. David Burke's curried noodle and oyster cake. Curried noodle, calamari noodles. It was calamari noodles with noodles and oysters and a crispy whatever it was. A nice dish, a hot appetizer, you know.
Sounds like it would fit right in today.
It was way ahead of its time. And I liked it a lot. And the oysters were nestled between the noodles, and they kind of steamed, and the noodles got crispy, et cetera. And the noodles were made with vermicelli and calamari.
So there are two kinds of noodles in that noodle.
Yes. Reaction. And the heads of the calamari were on the top, grilled or what have you. And the sauce was made with some vergeau or something like that. Anyway. And, you know, so it was a good dish. I liked it. People liked it. And I'm like, and this is before we printed menus in-house. And, you know, everything had to be perfect when you send it to the printer and this and that. They sent you back a proof. I'm like, shit, the worst dish to eat. I'm like, this. I was so devastated. I was like, the heat in my face. Aww. And I'm sitting way in the back. I got, like, the worst seat because I almost missed it. I'm, like, by the bathroom. I'm like, shit. Drew's in the front because they gave away my seat. And I'm like, ah. And then all of a sudden, here comes Drew pounding down. He's telling everybody on the plane that you see that guy sitting in the back? He's got the worst dish of the year. I'm like, You know, and that, if you know Drew, that's his personality. He's like, you know, he's busting my chops in a fun way. And I'm dead, but I'm devastated. I'm like 26 years old. I'm like maybe 27. I don't know. I'm like, oh, this is people reading it. You know, it's so much of a burden for me. Like, shit. I get off the plane. I call the sous chef. I call the manager. I said, is that dish suck? Something wrong with me? No. People, it's, you know, it's okay. This writer didn't like it. I forget who the writer was at the time. I go through the whole weekend making plans to reprint menus, which cost a lot of money back then, you know, just because you couldn't print in-house and, you know, take it off the menu. And anyway, look, the weekend was fine. We went, we ate this food. Drew and I had a great time. We had a lot of laughs. I get home Monday morning. I read New York Magazine. Best dish of the year, same dish. So, I'm like, you got to be shitting me. I'm like, stop the presses. And so it was just one of those things. And I use that because, you know, sometimes you second guess yourself. And for young cooks and chefs, you know, there's lots of critics out there, especially now with social media. You know, you have to, you go with your gut, you know, and you stick with it. If you know, this, not everyone's going to like everything. And back then we did experiment a lot and we were finding our way. And I think the food there was very avant-garde for its time. So, I mean, I served a smoked salmon consomme and a brandy snifter, which if you're a chef mm-hmm. and you make a consomme, and you especially out of fish, fatty fish, mm-hmm. it's a miracle that it was. And we made it like a
wow.
so, like a brandy, so clear and crystal and beautiful aroma. I served it in a snifter. And I had a critic write a review that said, this guy's out of his mind. What's he? You know, they said we think they brought the waiter. I thought the waiter was bringing me brandy to another table instead of appreciating the fact of the craftsmanship of taking the time to make a consomme, which takes a lot of time and a lot of hard
and
work
to take out the fattiness and all. This
we
stuff.
Were making. We made it with pecan. We were like challenging ourselves. How do we make? How do we take the fattiest thing, put in a
the
consomme,
most difficult
make it
thing
clear?
To yeah. make it completely clear?
Well, the fact of the matter is, somebody we smoked our own fish. Somebody over smoked. You know, 400 pounds of salmon, and we had a lot of salmon to use. So it was like, make consomme, make dumplings, make ravioli. So we had a lot to experiment with. But when you do experiment and you do have product available like that, you know, you push a little bit, and that's and one idea leads to another, and many of the ideas start one way and they wind up being something else. But the fact is, you're out there forging forward and pushing the envelope with ideas. So anyway, so the worst dish of the year story is like stick to your guns. Later on, I guess in '96, the same writer gave us best dish of the year for the crackling pork shank at Maloney and Porcelli. And I forget his name. Jerry Shriver, I think his name is. Yeah. And that was '96 when pork you didn't see on menus like you do now. And Alan Stillman, who was my partner at the time, who's from Smith & Wollensky, he also created TGI Fridays. Great, great restaurant. Great guy in general. And he's like, no one's ever going to order pork shank at a steakhouse. And I had eaten a pork shank like that in Munich. I was doing some work with the New Zealand Venison Board in Germany and teaching, actually, German chefs how to get creative with venison, which is that's another show that weekend. And I had this pork dish, and I was like, man, I can do something with this. And so that was a spit-roasted pork shank, because they call it Schweinshaxen. And so I brought that idea back, and we turned it into a world-class dish, that one dish of the year, and pork shank is just... So that was, you know, I take that just like I took the worst one, you know, the best one. And those are just, those are nice to get. But I'm telling you, I remember the weight on my shoulders of that worst one. So, and that's, you know what, you just forge your head.
Oh, my goodness. And you are doing a dream job, and I love the idea of the dream job. But my last question for you is, what would be your dream job if it weren't cooking? If you never found cooking?
You know what, if I didn't find cooking... I think my architecture, you know, I always liked glass blowing too. I know that's tough to make a living out of, but I know I took classes in Brooklyn years ago. And my friend Michael Ayu blows glass, and I was actually with him yesterday, and I love that painting. I know that's more of a hobby thing probably, but doing something with my hands or something that you can really show some creative expression. I mean, you know, like when I see the architects and people design restaurants and some of them, the way they design buildings and stuff, that kind of turns me on. It's like, wow, man, that must be great. great job. You know what I mean? Cooking would be a great hobby if I didn't do it for a living. But I never cook as a hobby. I don't cook at home because I do it for a living. But painting is something I want to dabble in a little bit. And I believe it or not, I want to take ventriloquism classes.
Wow.
I know that sounds so strange, but I bought a dummy not long ago. And I went online to try and take some class. I'm just so busy. But I think that would be funny.
Maybe once your wave of restaurants gets on its feet this year, maybe we can do a ventriloquism event.
Interview.
At one of your.
Well, I'd like him to expedite.
That's hilarious.
he can do all the yelling and in the kitchen. I think it's entertaining. I think it's. I don't know how hard it is because I really haven't given it a shot.
I think you're doing the talking without the moving of your lips already.
Okay.
It's happening. Well,
I guess the practice on the radio is good because they can't see your lips.
Absolutely. And I think you should get back in touch with Jackie the Singing Chef because she might...
Oh, that's a good
she
idea.
She might provide the musical accompaniment.
That's a great idea. Yeah. Jackie, hello, by the way.
Thank you so much for joining me today, David.
It's been a pleasure.
That's Chef David Burke. You're listening to Word of Mouth with Leyte Su on Heritage Radio Network. And we just have a little bit of time left. We're going to wind it down with Alex LaPratt. Head over to his restaurant, Atrium Dumbo, to talk why the Wines by the Glass list is the best indicator of a really, really great wine list.
Wine down.
I personally think the great benchmarks for a wine program, or a beverage program of integrity is the By the Glass list, or if you're working in a pairing menu situation at some of the nicer restaurants, then it would be the wine pairing. Because I believe it's important as a sommelier to offer the most integrity for what guests are going to enjoy the most often. So more guests are going to experience wines by the glass, or they're going to take the pairing on the tasting menu than any other single bottle on the entire list. But the thing that really irks me the most is a small by-the-glass selection that are fairly, mediocre. Like, you'll have, he only marks his wines up 2 times on the list by the bottle. But, yeah, it's because he's robbing everybody, or she, whoever wrote the program, is robbing everybody by getting a private label Chardonnay from California that they pay $7 a bottle for. And he charges you guys $14 a glass, and you guys pay it all day long. And everybody's like, oh, what a great list, what a great selection. But really, it's not. I think it's kind of bullshit. That really irks me. I want to get wines that have a sense of place, that have a sense of integrity, that have a very kind of classic style for that varietal. I mean, every once in a while, I'll throw in some stuff to rock the boat if people want to venture off it. But I think, you get those. And Leyte, we talked about it earlier. We were talking about there's a big debate about how abstract and how esoteric you can get with a list. I feel like a lot of people don't even know the classics that well, let alone these, off-the-beaten-paths, completely biodynamic, like so rare, the winemaker hasn't even tasted it themselves, wines, And I don't think that's necessarily what we always have to offer our guests. It's great when someone wants to dance that we have that option in our back pocket. And a lot of times you're going to know when to go there, and you probably have a bottle open in your program anyway that you can do that. I just think that Wines by the Glass should work well with the food, be really classic representations and great values from established regions. So I don't think there's any reason to, charge someone the price per glass that you bought per the bottle. It's just antiquated, and I see a lot of people with crappy Wines by the Glass that are way marked up, and yet everybody's raving about their selections on their wine list. It's just nonsense.
I get it. So, tell me about your list here. It's Dumbo. It's kind of an unusual neighborhood.
Right.
And you come from fine dining, Manhattan.
Yeah.
And gosh, you're just fine dining pro.
It's different when you have to put together a wine program that people are going to like, that works with the food, and it's tough to make that transition from a $3 million buying budget to something you're paying for by yourself. And wow. I try to do exactly what I just talked about. I try to pick wines by the glass. I try to offer a large selection. You know, at any time we'll have six white, six red still wines, you know, four or five sparkling, and, you know, six or seven dessert wines all available by the glass.
All right, so what are two wines that I'm going to try out tonight on your Wines by the Glass list?
Oh, by the glass. Okay, so there's two that... oh, now you're making me give out all my secrets.
Yeah.
Everyone's going to go buy it, and I can't get it. So one of my favorite whites by the glass right now, Domaine Boisson Vado. I remember when they were first imported about 3.5 years ago, 4 years ago. I tasted them, and I said, you know what? Hands down, one of the best white Burgundy as a Bourgogne Blanc that I've had in a long time. All declassified Marceau. You taste it blind. It tastes like Marceau. You're paying Bourgogne Blanc prices. You know, it's very rare. I think there's, I mean, only Coche in my mind does a better Bourgogne Blanc. Some will say Rouleau, but even then, I think it's, you know, a little bit of a different style. But this is all hazelnut, Meyer lemon, meringue. It's got this great oxidation, incredible acidity, super food friendly. So I love that wine. And that's by the glass. And then the red, Philip Fauré's Syrah from the Northern Rhone, one of the top producers, maybe the best Saint-Joseph for value, pound-to-pound Syrah in the Northern Rhone. Big, big fan. But he does a Vin de Paix where he sources grapes from just outside of that region. And it's like dirt cheap for the value. You can't beat it. A lot of campfire smoke, roasted meat, red and black fruits, black olive, violets. Super, super complex wine. And again, you don't have to pay for it.
What's that going to, what are, one glass of each, what's that going to set me back here?
I think the Syrah is $13. The Bourgogne Blanc is $15.
Wonderful.
You know, and they, I mean, basically you're drinking Saint-Joseph and Marceau by the glass without paying for it. It's outstanding.
Oh, amazing. Thank you so much, Alex.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
That was Alex Leprat, partner sommelier of Atrium Dumbo. You know, I'm happy to just hear from a guy who's worked at Jean-Georges, Le Bernardin, and with the Daniel Ballou group of restaurants. Love hearing about how democratic he is about the way that he structures his wine list, especially his wines by the glass. You know, people judge a wine list a lot of different ways, how big the selection is, how many verticals, full verticals that the list has, wine in all of its vintages so that you can pick and choose and taste all of them. Or maybe they look at, hey, this list has such old wines, has the oldest wine. They'll look at, a diner will look at a particular bottle that they know, a Dom Perignon, a Stag's Leap Cab, and then they happen to know, hey, it's this much over there and it's this much over here. And then they price compare based on just that one bottle that most people don't get a chance to try. And so the Wines by the Glass is what all of us get to enjoy. And I hope you go over there and check out Alex's list in Dumbo. This is Word of Mouth with Leti Su on Heritage Radio Network. Until next time, eat well, be swell.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.